Welcome to our deep dive, you guys. It's going to be a fascinating one. We're going to explore how ideas about the mind, the soul, and consciousness have evolved over time.
We'll be looking at some really cool sources, too. We have these academic texts like Historia, Pojaj, Dotichakshik, Omisuyu, and Ostap Gokogniti Wistiki.
Okay, so like some heavy-duty stuff.
Yeah, and then we also have this document called LO2MIDI.PDF, which should be pretty interesting.
So it's like a journey through time, from ancient beliefs to, you know, modern neuroscience, trying to figure out what makes us us.
Yeah, like how do people even begin to think about this thing we call the self?
Right, exactly.
Well, I think a good place to start is ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt.
Okay, so way back.
Way back when the soul wasn't just an abstract idea, but like this complex entity with different parts.
Okay, already I'm intrigued. So tell me more about that.
So the ancient Egyptians, for instance, they believed in this thing called the ka.
What, the ka?
Yeah, it was like a spirit double that needed to be fed even after death.
So like packing snacks for your soul's eternal road trip.
Exactly. Like you got to keep that ka happy.
Wow. So death wasn't the end. It was just a different stage of existence.
Right. And they took it very seriously.
Now, what about this soul bird I read about?
Oh, yeah, the ba.
The ba.
Yeah, so they believed this soul bird needed a spiritual form and a physical form to exist.
Interesting.
It's an idea that comes up again and again in later philosophies, this duality of the soul.
Okay, so the Egyptians, they were so focused on the afterlife. I'm guessing that like shaped their whole worldview.
Absolutely. Their whole society was geared toward preparing for that journey after death.
That's incredible. It really shows how these beliefs can shape entire civilizations.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so we talked about Egypt. Now let's hop over to ancient Greece. What were the Greeks thinking about all this soul stuff?
Well, if you start with Homer, he kind of describes the soul as a shadow.
A shadow. Kind of bleak, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
But even then, you start to see this shift toward thinking of the soul as a force that animates life.
Okay.
So like Thales, he compared the soul to a magnetic force.
Interesting. So a step up from just a wispy shadow.
Yeah, exact.
So the Greeks were already moving beyond that simple idea. What other theories did they have?
Well, you have Heraclitus, who thought the soul was made of fire.
Fire.
Yeah, constantly changing, you know, dynamic, a source of energy.
Okay.
And then you have Anaximander, who saw it as this thing made of ether.
Ether, now that sounds familiar.
It connects to this idea called panpsychism.
Okay.
So imagine consciousness not being limited to humans, but like permeating everything.
Whoa.
The whole universe.
Like the Gaia hypothesis, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where the earth itself is seen as this living being.
So even thousands of years ago, people were wrestling with these huge questions about consciousness.
Yeah, and it's still relevant today.
It's pretty mind-blowing. But we can't talk about ancient Greece without mentioning Plato and Aristotle.
Oh, of course not. They were like the heavy hitters.
Right. So what were their takes on the soul?
Well, Plato, he came up with this idea of the tripartite soul.
Tripartite meaning?
Three parts. The rational part, the spirited part, and the appetitive part.
Okay, so break that down for me.
Imagine a chariot.
A chariot.
Okay, so the rational part is the charioteer trying to control these two horses.
Okay.
One horse represents our base desires, you know, those primal urges.
Gotcha.
And the other horse represents, like, our noble spirit, you know, our higher aspirations.
So this inner struggle that we all experience.
Right, trying to find that balance.
Exactly. Like trying to resist that extra slice of cake.
Exactly.
So Plato was all about balance.
Yeah, he believed that reason should guide us.
Makes sense.
And actually, this three-part soul, it mirrored his idea of the ideal society.
Oh, how so?
Well, he thought philosophers, the ones guided by reason, they should rule.
Okay.
And then guardians, those driven by spirit, they should protect.
Okay.
And then workers motivated by desires, they should provide for everyone.
So a very hierarchical system.
Very much so. But then you have Aristotle, who took a more grounded approach.
Okay, so less ethereal, more practical.
Exactly. He wasn't so focused on the soul being separate from the body.
No joke.
He saw the soul as like this principle of life itself,
yeah.
Responsible for an organism's functions. Like even plants have a kind of soul, according to Aristotle.
So he was shifting the focus from the mystical to the observable.
Yeah, he was starting to lay the groundwork for a more biological understanding of the soul and eventually the mind.
So a major step towards a more scientific approach.
Right. But before we jump too far ahead, let's look at some other views that were floating around in ancient Greece.
Okay, so besides Plato and Aristotle, what other ideas were out there?
Well, the Stoics, for example, they believed the soul was breath, or pneuma.
Pneuma.
Yeah, this material force that flowed through the body. So then
Interesting.
when you die, it returns to this universal soul.
Okay.
And then you had the Epicureans who had this idea of the atomic soul.
Atomic soul.
Yeah, made of tiny particles that scattered when you die.
So a very different perspective.
Yeah, very much so. It's fascinating how many different ideas there were even back then.
It shows how complex this whole concept of the soul is.
Right.
Now, one of the ideas that I found really interesting was from Lucretius.
Oh, yeah,
They
Lucretius.
distinguish between anima and animus.
Yeah, in his work on the nature of things,
Exactly.
he makes that distinction between anima as like the biological soul.
So the one that keeps the body running.
Right. And then animus as this subtle soul that resides in the heart.
Interesting. So the animus is more about emotions, maybe.
Even thoughts.
Yeah, and this idea of the animus being in the heart, the seat of emotions,
Yeah.
it's surprisingly relevant to Jungian psychology.
Ooh, I didn't make that connection.
Yeah, it's interesting how these ancient ideas can connect to modern psychology.
So we've covered a lot of ground with the Greeks, but what was happening in other cultures?
Well, in Jewish philosophy, there was a whole spectrum of beliefs.
Okay.
So on one end, you had the Sadducees.
The Sadducees.
Yeah, they rejected anything mystical, like they didn't believe in an afterlife or an immortal soul.
Really? So very practical, down to earth
Exactly. And
thought.
then in contrast, you had the Pharisees,
Okay.
who believed in the transmigration of souls,
Meaning.
that the soul could be reborn into different bodies.
Wow, so like reincarnation.
Yeah, essentially. It's really interesting how all these different perspectives within Judaism then fed into the development of the soul concept in Christianity.
Oh, that's a good point. So how did early Christians view the soul?
Well, there were some interesting theories. One was from Tertullian. He suggested that the soul naturally emerges with the body.
So kind of like how we understand genetics today.
Yeah, like it's just part of the natural process.
Interesting. But I'm guessing not everyone agreed with that.
Oh, of course not. There were thinkers like Saint Gregory Thaumaturgus
Okay.
who argued that the soul is non-physical, you know, it's responsible for intellect and artistic expression.
So he put the soul firmly in the realm of the spiritual.
Exactly.
It's amazing how these early thinkers were already grappling with these big questions about the nature of consciousness.
Yeah, like how much of who we are is tied to our physical bodies and how much might transcend them. Right. And it's a question that we're still asking today.
Absolutely. It's one of those enduring mysteries.
Now, as we move into the Middle Ages, we see this new attempt to reconcile faith and reason.
Right, scholasticism.
And this is where someone like St. Thomas Aquinas comes in.
Exactly. He was trying to bridge the gap between Aristotelian philosophy and Christian theology.
Okay, so how did he approach the concept of the soul?
Well, one of his most influential ideas was this hierarchy of souls.
A hierarchy. So, like different levels of soul.
Exactly. He proposed three levels: vegetative, sensitive, and rational.
Okay, so break that down for me. What does each level represent?
So think of it like a video game character with different levels unlocked.
Okay, I like that analogy.
So at the most basic level, you have plants. They have the vegetative soul
Okay, responsible
for
after.
growth and reproduction, just the basic functions of life.
Gotcha.
Then you have animals. They unlock the next level, the sensitive soul,
Which includes?
sensory perception, basic cognition,
Yep.
reacting to their environment.
Yeah.
And then finally, you have humans. We reach the top level, the rational soul.
So that's where higher thinking and self-awareness come in.
Exactly. It's like a progression from simple to complex.
And it actually maps pretty well onto what we know about biology and the brain.
It does. The vegetative soul aligns with our understanding of metabolism,
Okay.
the sensitive soul with the brain's sensory areas and the limbic system,
Okay.
and then the rational soul with the neocortex, the part of the brain responsible for those higher level thought processes.
It's incredible how these ideas from centuries apart can converge like that.
It really is. It makes you wonder if there are these fundamental truths about the human mind that we keep rediscovering.
Now, Aquinas' hierarchy kind of reminds me of Freud's id, ego, and superego.
That's a good comparison. The id representing our base desires, the ego, our rational self, and the superego, our moral conscience.
And you could even compare it to Paul MacLean's triune brain model.
Oh, yeah. With the reptilian brain for basic survival, the limbic system for emotions, and the neocortex for complex thought.
It's like these thinkers across time were all tapping into something fundamental about how our minds work.
Even if they didn't have the scientific tools to fully understand it.
Exactly. But as we know, history doesn't always follow a straight line.
Right. With the scientific revolution and the rise of materialism, the traditional view of the soul started to face some challenges.
Yeah, people were starting to question those old ideas.
And that's where someone like Julien Aufray de Lemaître comes in.
Lemaître. He was a pretty radical thinker for his time.
Oh, he was definitely ahead of his time. He argued that humans are essentially complex machines.
Machines.
Yeah, he believed that all those mental functions, they arise from the body itself.
So no separate and material soul.
Not in his view. His book, Man a Machine, caused quite a stir.
I bet it was pretty controversial to suggest that we're just biological machines.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And his other writings, including The Art of Enjoyment, they were considered dangerous.
Really?
Yeah, they were banned in a lot of places, even in relatively liberal Holland.
Wow. So even talking about pleasure was taboo back then.
It seems so, but Lemaître's ideas marked a turning point.
A turning point in how we thought about the soul.
Exactly. The focus shifted from the soul to the mind.
So instead of asking, what is the soul? People started asking, what is the mind and how does it work?
Exactly. And one of the key figures who bridged this transition was John Locke.
John Locke.
He defined consciousness as the perception of what passes in a man's own mind.
So we're not experiencing the world directly.
Right. We're experiencing our own mental representations of it.
It's like our brains are creating a simulation of reality.
That's a good way to put it. And this realization opened up a whole new avenue of inquiry, the exploration of the subjective nature of experience.
And the inner workings of the mind.
Exactly. And as thinkers delve deeper, they inevitably stumbled upon the concept of unconscious processes
The unconscious, this hidden realm of the mind,
that influences our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors.
in ways we're not even aware of.
Right. It's like there's this whole other world operating beneath the surface.
And this idea of the unconscious, it started with some early thinkers like Benjamin Carpenter.
He was one of the first to observe the power of unconscious biases.
And emotional reactions.
Yeah, and these observations paved the way for Freud's psychoanalysis and our modern understanding of the unconscious.
It's amazing how these early, almost anecdotal observations led to such a fundamental concept in psychology and
It
neuroscience.
really is. It shows how powerful those early insights can be.
So we've gone from the soul to the mind, and now we're exploring the depths of the unconscious.
But even the concept of mind itself, it wasn't safe from scrutiny.
Oh, really? So after centuries of debate about the soul, now the mind was being questioned.
Exactly. There were all these philosophical perspectives that challenged the traditional view.
Okay, so tell me about some of these critiques of the mind.
Well, you have eliminative materialism. These thinkers wanted to get rid of terms like mind altogether.
Clearly.
They argued that they're too vague and unscientific.
So instead of talking about the mind, they would just focus on the physical processes of the brain.
Exactly. Then there was Gilbert Ryle, who challenged this idea of the ghost in the machine, this idea that the mind is somehow separate from the body.
Right.
He saw the mind as a way of describing our behaviors and tendencies.
So instead of a separate entity, the mind is more like a pattern of activity, a way of talking about how we interact with the world.
Yeah, a good way to put it. And then you have logical behaviorism, which tried to reduce mental states to observable behaviors.
So no internal experience, just outward behavior.
Right. They would say that being in pain isn't about some inner feeling, but about exhibiting behaviors like crying out or wincing.
That seems a little extreme.
It does to many.
Yeah.
And finally, you have identity theory, which proposed that mental events are literally identical to brain states.
So the mind's the brain. No distinction between the two.
Basically, yes. And all these challenges to the mind concept, they show just how complex and debated this connection is between our subjective experiences and what's happening in our brains.
It's a question that continues to fascinate and puzzle us.
Absolutely. And despite all the advances in science and all these philosophical critiques, the belief in the soul, it persists.
It does. And the Polish text that we looked at, they offer some interesting insights into why that is.
Right. They suggest that the soul concept, it offers comfort in the face of death and the unknown.
It's like a way to cope with our own mortality, the idea that some part of us might live on.
Exactly. And for many, this belief is deeply tied to their faith, their sense of purpose, and their understanding of right and wrong.
It gives them a moral framework, a reason to be good, and a hope that goes beyond this life.
And even if we set aside the religious aspect, there's still this question of what it means to be conscious feeling beings in a purely material world.
It's a big question, and one that cognitive science is trying to help us answer.
And that's something we'll continue to explore as we delve deeper into this fascinating world of the human mind.
I can't wait.
It's going to be quite a journey.
It already is.
It
So
is.
buckle up, everybody.
We're just getting started.
Wow, it's like we got on this mental archaeological dig. uncovering all these different layers of thought about the soul and the mind. And it really makes you think about, like, what does it all mean for us today?
It is kind of like that. And,
yeah.
You know, it's not just an intellectual exercise either. These ideas have real implications for how we understand ourselves and our place in the world.
Right. And I think for some people, the idea that the mind is just a product of the brain, a physical organ, that can be unsettling.
Yeah, it can be for some people. It can make them feel like we're just biological machines with no free will or purpose.
I can see that. But, I mean, think about it this way. Like, understanding how a flower grows, you know, it's intricate structures. Yeah. It doesn't make it any less beautiful, does it?
No, not at all. In fact, it can even deepen our appreciation for it, you know, its complexity and its resilience.
Right. So maybe understanding the brain, this incredible organ that gives rise to all of our thoughts and emotions and everything that makes us human, maybe that can actually make us appreciate ourselves even more.
I think so. It's like looking through a microscope and discovering a whole hidden world teeming with life and activity. It doesn't take away from the beauty we see with the naked eye. It expands our understanding.
Okay, I like that. That's a good way to think about it. So instead of being afraid of this scientific understanding, we can embrace it as a way to, like, learn more about ourselves.
Yeah, embrace that curiosity.
Right, but I'm still kind of wrestling with this idea of free will. If our brains are just biological machines shaped by evolution, does that mean we're not really in control of our choices?
Well, that's a question that's been around for a long time. And cognitive science doesn't have all the answers, but it does offer some interesting insights.
Okay, like what?
Well, for example, we know that our brains are constantly making predictions. You know, trying to anticipate what's going to happen next based on our past experiences.
So, like, our brains are these prediction machines always trying to figure out what's coming next.
Exactly. And this predictive processing, it shapes our perceptions, our thoughts, even our actions in ways that we're often not even aware of.
It makes you wonder how much control we really have.
It does, doesn't it?
If our brains are operating on autopilot, so to speak.
Right. So maybe instead of asking, do I have free will? The better question is, what kind of choices do I want to make given everything I know about myself, my brain, and the world around me?
That's a good point. Maybe it's not about having absolute free will, but more about understanding the factors that influence our choices and then making conscious decisions within those constraints.
That's a great way to put it.
It's like we're all dealt a hand of cards, but we get to decide how we play them.
I like that analogy.
So it makes it a little bit less abstract and a little bit more practical.
Right. It gives you a sense of agency.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we have this incredible power to shape our lives, even if we're not operating in a complete vacuum.
And cognitive science can help us understand those influences, you know, those rules of the game, so to speak. It can help us make more informed decisions and live more fulfilling lives.
So if we can shift our perspective a little bit and see our brains as these amazing complex organs that allow us to experience the world and make choices and connect with others, then maybe we can start to see this scientific understanding as something that's empowering rather than something to fear.
I agree with that. I think that's a really important shift in perspective.
Okay, now I have another question for you. We've talked a lot about the scientific view of the mind, but what about those more spiritual beliefs in the soul? Why do those persist even in the face of all this scientific evidence?
That's a great question. And it's something that those Polish texts that we were looking at, they address that pretty directly. They suggest that the soul concept, it offers a lot of comfort, especially when we're confronted with, you know, things like death and the unknown.
It's like a way to cope with those big existential questions.
Right. It gives people a sense of hope that maybe something of us continues on even after our physical bodies are gone.
And for a lot of people, those beliefs are tied to their faith. You know, their sense of purpose in life. It gives them a moral framework, a reason to strive for goodness.
And a sense of belonging.
So while science might provide one way of understanding the mind, these spiritual beliefs offer a different kind of understanding. One that resonates with people on a much deeper level.
Yeah, a more emotional level, perhaps.
Exactly. And who's to say that one is right and the other is wrong? Maybe they both offer valuable insights into the human experience.
I think that's a really important point. It's not about choosing sides, but about recognizing that different ways of knowing can coexist and even complement each other.
Yeah, it's like looking at a tapestry from different angles.
I like that.
You might see different patterns and colors, but it's all part of the same intricate work of art.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
And maybe that's the key takeaway from all of this. Whether we're talking about the soul or the mind, the brain or consciousness, we're ultimately trying to understand this remarkable thing that allows us to experience the world. to feel emotions, to form relationships, to create art, to ask questions, to search for meaning.
You said it perfectly. It's a journey of exploration, a quest to understand what it means to be human in all of its complexity and wonder.
And that journey is far from over.
Oh, it's just beginning.
And on that note, let's just take a little pause and let all these ideas sink in for a bit. We've covered a lot of ground, but I have a feeling there's much more to explore. All right, so we're back. And, you know, after all that talk about the soul and the mind and the brain, I'm still left with this question. Like, if the mind really is just the brain, a product of evolution, where does that leave the idea of the human spirit? Does understanding the mechanics somehow take away the magic?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I think it gets to the heart of why a lot of people are hesitant to embrace a purely scientific view of things. But let me ask you this. Do you think understanding how a clock works makes it any less beautiful or intricate?
That's a good point. I guess knowing the mechanics doesn't necessarily diminish the wonder. If anything, it can make you appreciate the craftsmanship even more.
Right. And think about it. The human brain is arguably the most complex machine in the known universe. It's incredible that this collection of cells can generate thoughts and emotions and memories, even a sense of self. That's pretty awe-inspiring, wouldn't you say?
It's absolutely. And it's not static either. The brain is constantly changing and adapting and learning. It's almost like this ever-evolving landscape.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And that dynamic nature is what makes studying the mind so fascinating. You know, we're constantly uncovering new insights and refining our understanding and pushing the boundaries of what we thought was possible.
So maybe instead of seeing science as a threat to the idea of the human spirit, we can see it as a tool to explore and appreciate its depths even more.
I think that's a really healthy way to look at it. It's not about replacing those big questions with cold, hard facts. It's about enriching our understanding and expanding our sense of wonder and recognizing the remarkable capabilities of this thing we call the brain.
And if the brain is constantly changing and learning and adapting, does that mean the human spirit is too deal?
That's a really profound question, and I think it's one that we'll continue grappling with for a long time. But it's exciting to think about the possibilities. If the mind really is this dynamic, evolving entity, then who knows what the human spirit is capable of?
It makes you realize that this deep dive we've taken, it's just the beginning of a much larger journey.
It really is.
A journey of discovery and understanding and maybe even transformation.
I like that. And as we wrap up this exploration, I want to leave you with one final thought.
Okay, I'm listening.
If the mind is truly a product of the brain, a physical entity shaped by evolution and experience, does that make our capacity for love and compassion and creativity and all those things we associate with the soul, does it make them any less meaningful or real? Or does it make them even more remarkable knowing that they arise from this incredible organ?
That's a really good question to think about. And as we continue to learn more about cognitive science, I think we'll find that the answers are often more complex and surprising than we might expect.
I agree. The journey of understanding the mind is an ongoing adventure, and it's one that everyone can be a part of.
That's a great point. So stay curious, everyone. Keep asking those questions and never stop exploring this amazing landscape of the human mind.
Well said.
And on that note, we'll bring this deep dive to a close. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey. And until next time, keep those minds engaged and those spirits soaring.